Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, a.k.a. Roger Ebert and Me, colon, movie reviews for optimal search engine optimization. It's a weekly movie review podcast and also a tribute to Siskel and Ebert, hosted by film critic Mark Dusick and film critic, in quotes, myself, Brett Arnold. We aim to cover every new theatrical release and every new streaming release every Friday in the format Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert pioneered. We aim to be the guide to the new release movies. What you should watch, you can just come here and we'll tell you, hey, this one was good, this one was bad, this one is the best thing you've ever seen, there's artistic merit, this one doesn't have any artistic merit. We're the deciders of artistic merit on this podcast. that's ultimately
no pressure
what it's about. We're the arbiters of taste, and that's what we're here to talk about. This week we have 7 movies to talk about, which sounds like a lot, but then you go over to markreviewsmovies.com and he's got 13, making me look like an absolute slacker for watching 7. One of the 13 is the Johnny Depp, I don't want to call it like his big return movie, because it doesn't feel like that at all. It's more a foreign film that he's in that played at a film festival a year ago and is now slithering out in the US, kind of. And I just want to say, there's no moral reason why I didn't watch that movie. It just sounded boring, and every single review said it was terribly boring. So can you justify that? My skip of that? Was that a good skip?
It is boring.
Okay.
So there you go. It was good. I have justified it for you.
Boom. It was boring.
It's a French period romance that's not romantic or sexy or anything. It's just like, oh, hey, this was this person who was the lover to King Louis the 15th, and it didn't work out well for any of them. Oh, okay. Fun.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. There's something called Mars Express. That's an animated movie. Is that a French movie as well?
Yeah, that's French too. And that's cool. That builds a really convincing.
That's the Mark Reviews movies promise. Every week there'll be at least one movie from France that we don't like and one movie from France that we will recommend. That's the promise. There's a Hulu movie called Prom Dates. There's a Hulu documentary called The Contestant. These are all the things we're not talking about. I don't know why I'm fixating on that. I always do. It's not a
your self-flagellation
thing.
Period.
Exactly.
This is why you don't skip the intro.
Right.
Because you get to
exactly. I self-flagellate for a few minutes.
Flagellate himself.
There's a list that I keep, Mark, of movies that I've missed that I do want to catch up with, and it's not that long. But that Mars Express French animated thing is definitely on there. But let's get right into the 7 we will be covering, because there are how many wide releases? I guess Tarot's a wide release. There's at least 2 wide release multiplex films. We've got two really big, I would say, streaming movies in an Anne Hathaway starring Amazon Prime rom-com, or I guess just a romantic movie. I don't know. I think it's kind of a comedy. And then a Jerry Seinfeld comedy on Netflix about the invention of the Pop-Tart. But there's also a limited release movie that will go wide in a week or two from A24 called I Saw the TV Glow. If you know anything about, I guess, me and my horror podcast, you know I'm a huge fan of Jane Schoenbrunn's previous film, We're All Going to the World's Fair. Is that what it was called? I believe. Really interesting, strange movie. And now they have real money from A24, and they have a follow-up film called I Saw the TV Glow that, spoiler alert, is one of my favorite movies of the year. So I've thrown it at the top of the show after The Fall Guy, so we can talk about it at length, I hope, because there's a lot to talk about. Let's just get right into it, though. Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt in The Fall Guy. It's going to be a fun discussion. Here's the trailer.
That's me, Colt Seavers, and this is my hero's journey.
Or just start from the top.
Okay, I'm not the hero of this story. I'm just a stunt guy. Trying to look cool in front of the director of this movie. That's her, who I just so happen to have a major crush on.
We need to keep it super professional.
Cool. Do you want to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
Making out?
Yeah.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
There's just one little wrinkle.
The star of the movie,
Tom Ryder,
is missing. We need you to find him.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. No one's going to notice whether you're here or not. No offense.
I mean, some taken.
I'm going to say right up top, Mark, I knew we were in trouble pretty early in this movie that I'm ultimately probably still going to recommend. Don't get too excited. When it starts with a montage of like a celebration of stunt work that just includes heavily this guy's other movies, like it has Atomic Blonde right up top. I'm like, when I think amazing stunt work in movies, my mind doesn't jump to Atomic Blonde, the David Leitch movie that a lot of people like and I never really enjoyed. And now that man has given us Bullet Train, and he gave us the unbearable Fast and Furious spinoff, Hobbs and Shaw, I believe he directed that. He's not a director I enjoy. So I'm going to, my capsule review before I let Mark take it away, because Mark is more passionate about this movie, I would say, than I am, in a different direction. I found this movie to be just charming enough and just fun enough, very much in spite of its director and not because of him. This is a movie where the stars and their chemistry entirely carry it. The material lets them down at every turn, I would say, and they are constantly fighting to keep you invested, and they do a good job. Gosling especially, who really, you know, has to carry it, is so good in pure movie star mode. The problem with this movie, which is supposed to be a love letter to stunt work and a celebration of stunts and stuntmen and doing things practically and not doing digital face overlays and doing it the cheap, easy way, this movie, in my mind, completely lacks the spectacle that you'd hope to see in a movie that's a celebration of stunts and doing things practically. It's perfectly engaging enough, and it does have some laughs, but I would say it's an equal number of things that made me laugh and equal number of things that made me roll my eyes at how stupid and annoying it is. And the craziest thing that you start your review with this, which is over the end credits, they do reveal some things that were practically done, and there is some stunt work going on. And that just proves my point that David Leitch is such a bad director that even when using stunts and practical stuff, he can't convey that in a way that is meaningful on screen. It comes across as fake looking and bad and poorly put together and edited. There's a shot in this movie early on where he like breaks the 180 degree rule, and I just like a character was like on one side of the screen and then he was on the other, and it just felt so incompetent that it ultimately, it's the most 2.5, 3 I'm gonna ever give, or the most recommendable 2.5 I'm ever gonna give, because it does have that charm. I do think it's in there, and it's all because of the stars, but man, it's like a struggle to get there. And it just made me wish I were watching The Nice Guys, because it feels like a lesser Shane Black pastiche when you get to the actual mystery of it all. Please take it away.
The stunts are a big problem, and I don't know how to get around it. They do look fake. It looks a lot like green screen a lot of the times. And so that was what was so shocking about the behind-the-scenes stuff during the end credits. They did a lot of stuff, like that dumpster being dragged behind the truck. That was done for real, but it looked fake. It looked like they were on a set with a green screen, with the dumpster prop spinning, Gosling's character surfing behind the truck. That looked entirely fake, but then you see an actual stuntman doing it. I don't know how Leitch screwed this up to make real stunts look fake, but he somehow pulled it off.
He's a bad director.
It took me out of a movie that I was already out of, because Gosling and Emily Blunt, they're both charming actors, but saying that they had an uphill battle with this material is an understatement. There's nothing to this. There's nothing to this. It's just, it feels like improvised banter that's not that funny.
It is improvised banter.
Because I was watching that trailer and I don't remember those lines. The lines are forgettable to begin with, but I don't remember a lot of those lines in the movie, and I think they're like B-roll of improvising. There's way too much self-referential humor for a movie that doesn't pull off what it's trying to do. So it's forcing us to pay attention to the dynamic between the lead actor and the stunt double, when I'm just thinking, like, Ryan Gosling is a major movie star. He's got a stunt double. He's not doing any of this stuff for real. I think casting Gosling might have been a mistake. I'm going to say it flat out. I think they should have found an actual stunt performer, paid him a bit more than scale, who could carry a movie. They're out there. I'm sure they're out there. And let someone become a movie star off of the fact that they're doing stunts for real and have a bit of charm. Why not do that?
the woman who starred in Tarantino's Death Proof is my only reference for like a stunt woman who's been starring in a movie, and she's great. And she was in Malignant. I agree with that. But at the same time, without Ryan Gosling's charm, which I guess the stunt person hopefully could have brought.
That's what I'm saying. There's got to be someone out there.
This movie's nothing without him. And it's funny because I said there's stuff that annoys me. Like there's one scene I remember that did make me laugh, even though it all feels kind of labored. Is that the problem? Like they're talking about their relationship, but they're actually talking about the set of the movie. You hated that?
The split screen? I hated that. I hated the split screen phone conversation where they're like, should we do a scene in split screen?
And that's it goes on. Yeah, that forever. Stuff sucks.
The way that the action is intercut with little bits, like Emily Blunt's character doing karaoke or in the editing room, I think there's it just breaks the momentum of both of those scenes, the trying to do the comedy and all of that with Blunt's character. And then the action. Why would you cut from the action? That is the whole it says it in the movie that it's the whole point is the action and trying to shine a light on all the stunt performers. And yet you cut away from it. It's such a miscalculation on so many levels.
One of the biggest problems, too, is, again, they're working against the material because I keep saying that they're charming and it's fun enough because of their star power. But man, they don't give you any like, let's get invested in this relationship stuff with the characters. It just kind of starts and you have to like understand where they're at and just go like, yeah, this witty banter is what you have to just like, that's all you get. You get the witty banter. That's it. They're not really three dimensional characters in that way. So like, that's a big problem when you're trying to make us care about a romance too. So it's like David Lynch is a stunt person. Ostensibly, he is he's a stunt performer who became a director because of his connection to John Wick, I believe is what happened. And now he directed Deadpool 2. He's directed a bunch of stuff. And like clearly he knows how to do stunts because you see in the end credits that they exist and they probably looked good on when they were doing it. But he's clearly this guy should stick to stunts maybe because directing them gets away from him. Because as you're saying, there are the action in this movie as it's cut and put together on screen as you're watching it as an audience member. It's incomprehensible and ugly and not exciting. It does not have any of the like gasp inducing moments that like Mission Impossible has, or even Dune when Dune opens and there's this cool spectacle of like dudes flying around. It's just kind of like a take your breath away spectacle thing. That's done practically for the most part with and all that stuff. And it's crazy that the Fall Guy just never gets you to that point. It just doesn't deliver where it needs to. So yeah, I'm ultimately 2.5 out of 4. It's a 3 out of 5, but 2.5 out of 4 movie where I really, really, really want to recommend it. And I still cautiously am. I think it's good enough. It's just like, I see some people defending it as like it needs to be palpable for mainstream audiences. So what? It has to be like dumb and bad? Like I don't know what that means. Like why can't there is a version of this movie that's good? It just has a better director, I think, and once over on the script that makes it less annoying. But like the general idea here is fun. The idea that it's based on this old TV show and that the wonderful theme song plays over the end credits, which I really like the song and was listening to it on Spotify. I thought it was a fun, cool song. I understand this is supposed to be a franchise starter. I don't really see it as one. I don't think it will be one. I hope it's a box office hit because I like the idea of it, of celebrating stunt work. I like that the movie makes a joke about the Oscars not giving movies Oscars for stunts and how on the red carpet, Ryan Gosling's been just kind of advocating for that. And that's what the movie's about. So I totally support that message. But this movie isn't good enough for me to fully get behind, despite having some charm to it. That's my capsule.
Despite recommending it, it's not good enough for you to get behind.
I'm not at 2.5.
It's 2.5. I know it's on the fence. I get it. I get it. I've done those.
Like, I don't want to discourage people from like supporting.
I do. That's the problem here.
Yeah. Okay.
We are at different. We're at a crossroads on this movie because we've finally gotten to it. I still don't get where your stance is though. Just because Gosling is good in it, is that really it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm telling you, it's like a pure star. It's pure movie star performance stuff where like they sell it, and I'm having a good time. And there are some moments like the mysteries. Like, you know, it's engaging enough on a stupid movie level, but like it just keeps making you think of Shane Black stuff. So I guess it in that way, it's not like super engaging, but like it just kept being good enough to the point where it never soured. I never soured fully on it, but I also never like there's people who, you know, South by Southwest hype walked out saying it was the best movie of the year. It's going to be huge, blah, blah, blah. And like overhype is a real thing. I don't want people to get overhyped. So I'm just trying to be reasonable. It's not great. It's not terrible. Mark thinks it's
I think it's terrible. I think it's pretty terrible.
You think it's pretty terrible?
I think it's insufferable at times.
Speak more. Yeah, speak more on it.
Well, I don't know what else to say. The mystery isn't engaging. I didn't find the romance convincing. I don't think the fact that, you know, Blunt and Gosling are kind of joking about the relationship on this very fundamental level makes it shows that they have chemistry. I didn't think that was effective. And yeah, and then the worst part of all, the stunts don't work. We both agree on that, right?
Yes,
the stunts, which is as they are shown, do not work in this movie. And if this movie is entirely about shining a light on the stunt industry and how people should be respected and how all that hard work should be shown, shouldn't we get a sense of how dangerous and how tough it is to be able to do that and how unsung they are within the industry? You never get that sense because it's so distracted by everything else, by the mystery, by the romance, by the I don't even know what else. So by the satire, I guess, of Hollywood, which is all thin stuff. Johnson's character.
Yeah, and like the big movie that's like Dune, but also Mad Maxy, but also Zack Snydery. It's all just I think it's one of those things where I see the version of this movie that I love, and it's frustrating because it's not that. But I don't know. Like, my wife really wants to see it, and she knows my feelings on it. And she still, it's like the one movie that she's, since the baby, she's like, I kind of want to go see that. And I'm like, okay. Like, I kind of want to be like, go for it. I support that. Go see it. But like, just know it's not going to blow your socks off or anything. But like, if I'm comparing this to the last movie I saw with my wife, which I think was like The Lost City, this is like a million times better than that to me. And like, I see you don't, don't agree.
I don't agree with that, but
that's fine.
We both agree that that's not good. Lost City.
Yes. All right. Well, anyway, Mark and I need to get back in harmony. So Mark, how many stars are you giving The Fall Guy?
I'm giving The Fall Guy 1.5 stars. I really didn't like it.
I think, I was delighted when I saw your review drop because most people are giving it a pass, you know, because I think it's the like fun enough. They're charming. It worked despite the material thing. And you said, nay, I will not give it a pass. Fuck this movie. And I appreciate that. 2.5 stars for me. I'm right in the middle. Let's get back in harmony. Mark and I are going to talk about I Saw the TV Glow, a movie that I think we could talk about it for an hour and still not ruin the experience of seeing it, no matter how in-depth we get. It is a surreal, crazy experience to watch. It's not going to be for everybody, but the people it's for are going to love it to the point where it's life-changing. And I will explain what that all means. It sounds crazy, but I do mean it. And I will explain that all after the trailer for I Saw the TV Glow.
I know this might sound crazy. I don't want to alarm you.
Do you remember a TV show we used to watch together? It was called...
The Big of Eight?
Yeah. Do you watch?
Each episode, they help each other fight a new monster from across the county. But it's way too scary for most kids.
We're going to defeat him this time. We're going to need to harness the full potential of our shared powers.
Sometimes the Pink Opaque feels more real than real life.
Maddie, it was a TV show.
Are you sure that's all it was?
Goosebumps just watching that trailer. I have watched this movie twice. I went to two different screenings. I am obsessed with it. It was a movie that the first time I did like it a lot, but I found it it perplexed me a little bit. I don't think I understood the ending or where it was, like, it just felt abrupt to me. And the second time I was able to really luxuriate in it, and I feel like I have a really good grasp on it. But what's amazing about this movie is that it's very open to interpretation of the viewer's experience. Like, Mark and I could talk about this movie for an hour in two completely different directions. I could talk about it as a reading about trans identity and gender dysphoria, and Mark could talk about it for an hour and not mention that at all, and it would still be a perfectly relevant conversation about how the movie's about the escape of nostalgia, but also the prison of nostalgia, and how you can't be your only outlet, and how you have to let your in, you know, what's inside of you out, or look what will happen to you. It's a cautionary tale. It's so unnerving, but it's also so exciting. It has some of the best music. I can't remember the last time I pre-ordered an album after watching a movie, and I already have for this, because I love the completely original soundtrack that the director hand-plucked her favorite bands and gave them A24 money and said, give me an original song. And all the songs are great. I have to stop talking. Mark, please give me some sense of direction and talk about what this movie is to you and why you connected with it so much, because you also are not like a 3-star pass. It's like a big... wow, this was something.
Yeah, this is something unique, even though it is very much in the vein of something like David Lynch. It's very much in that vein, where it's more about the emotional and dream logic of it than it is the narrative logic. I think if you try to focus specifically on what the story is about, you're kind of going to get lost in the weeds, because it's not really about the story. It is this tale about this young kid who is obsessed with a TV show that he has never seen before, but he just sees like clips of it on TV and the ads, and is like, I got to watch this. And so he ends up with a classmate sneaking over for a pretend sleepover to watch an episode of the show, and then really becomes hooked. And it just becomes the crux of his life, like throughout high school. And so it's about that, but it's also about the mythology of the show to a degree, which is called The Pink Opaque. And it's about these telepathic teen girls who can communicate with each other, and they solve Monster of the Week mysteries like on The X-Files or Buffy. I don't even know what else. There's so much going on. There's weird creatures. It's very much,
I would say, creepy. Yeah, the comparison I keep hearing is it's clearly Buffy because it uses the Buffy font, but it's very Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's very Twin Peaksy. It's very just, yeah, young adult. Alex Mack, I also saw referenced. It's just very, but like the beauty of that, like pastiche stuff, is that it's done so well that it's not done like ironically or like, look how stupid this is. It's like, you get why they're obsessed with it, kind of, because the aesthetic is so real to the what it's trying to evoke. It just nails the aesthetic so well.
Yeah, it feels like something that you would catch and be like, what is this? What is the show? Because the monsters are creepy. The ice cream man melting away is really creepy. But it's not about the mythology of the show either. It's that it really is just something for these characters to latch onto, to feel something. Even if we don't really feel like directly what it is, it's for them to feel it, because nothing else about their lives. They're stuck in the suburbs, which there's so much going on here. I'm like, as soon as I said the suburbs, I'm thinking about the way that it's depicted in those early scenes with all the neon sidewalk chalk all over, and the way that Schoenbrunn, brings in the elements of the show into the real world, supposedly, and just even the subtle use of the aspect ratio, where you have the old boxy TV, and sometimes elements of the show will be in widescreen, and you start to realize like, oh, this is which is it? Where are we? Are we in the show? Are we in the real world? Or has the line been crossed where nothing is real anymore? And that's what it kind of really gets down to. It's just that sense of feeling completely outside of yourself, outside of any kind of place in the world. I don't know. It's all about emotion. That's really what it was for me, is that it drew me in with that feeling of loneliness and isolation and just not feeling a part of anything. I think everybody in high school, even probably the most popular kids in high school, feel that to some degree. So it's one of those movies that you can find a specific allegory to decode in this. And I think you're definitely going to talk about that later. It's that, and it is also this very universal story about just feeling as if life is not going the way you want it to and you can't figure out why. And what do you need to do to figure it out? It's so good on that level.
It's
on the
frankly
level.
Staggering. It's like staggering to me to think about what it accomplishes.
But then it's backed up by real filmmaking chops and that soundtrack. That soundtrack, you're right. That soundtrack is just fantastic.
It's fantastic. There are not only are like the individual songs, like, yes, these are like earworm songs that I really want to hear again, but like the way that really long monologue that basically is the halfway point of the movie that kind of shifts things to a different place, the way that the music is incorporated into that and the way it hits when she like hits the like climax of her story, it's just like, it made me, it's just one of those movie moments where you're like, this is fucking cinema, man. Like, she's using the soundtrack, she's using the visuals, she's using the allegory, it's all happening in front of you. And it's just like, there's several moments throughout the movie that kind of took my breath away. And then, like, I'm going to get emotional just talking about the ending. Like, it's hard to talk about. It's like you're watching someone like rip themselves open and finally acknowledge what they've been putting down their whole life. And like, the movie is kind of, it's one of those things. So listen, you don't need any context to enjoy this movie for what it is. But if you do have the context of like, this is a non-binary trans filmmaker who didn't come out as trans until they were in their 30s. And they have said that this movie, when they introduced it in New York at the premiere, they said, this is a movie about the egg crack, which is what trans people call the moment that they, you know, knew that they were like not what, you know, their bodies weren't right. Like, I'm a woman, but I'm living in a man's body. Like, the egg crack moment. Like, what is it? And in The People's Joker, another trans film we talked about, that's also about the egg crack moment, about someone realizing they were trans. And it's funny because The People's Joker, Vera Drew, has said it's like watching, what was it, Batman Forever with Nicole Kidman, egg crack moment. And that's why, like, we have The People's Joker. But anyway, watching this movie with that context of it's a person, like a person who just figured out that they were trans, trying to make like a cautionary tale for other people who feel like her, who spent 30 years not knowing what the feeling inside of them was. And that this movie is them putting that out there for other people to discover. Like, I'm going to cry. It's so fucked up that I'm crying on the podcast, but like, it is so overwhelmingly emotional to me. And you can find Letterboxd reviews that Jane has been sharing of people who it's already happening. Someone watched this movie at a festival last week and did a whole Letterboxd post about, hey, never said this out loud before, I'm a trans woman and this movie helped me get there. So like, it's incredible that this movie is like literally life-changing for people. And that's in there. And it's amazing to me. I'm not trying to belittle you or anyone else who doesn't see the trans or gender stuff in there. It's just like, there's a whole aspect of this movie that is for queer people to read that isn't for us to read. And like, you can read it, sure, it's there if you want to look for it, but like, we didn't clue into that, like, you know, innately, because that's not what we're there for. I was watching it, I was like, as someone who grew up with a neighbor who showed me horror movies before I should have seen them, and like, my mom wouldn't let me watch stuff late at night, like, you resonate with that. And you resonate with just the, as you're saying, the very general idea in the specificness of the trans stuff, the specific idea of seeing yourself in media, and that is what teaches you about your own self. Like, oh, I didn't know that about myself until I saw Nicole Kidman in Batman Forever. Now I know I'm gay or whatever. Like, we all have those moments, whatever they may be, with media. So this movie is for anyone who's ever watched a movie and felt a connection or felt something change in them. And it's so cool that it's so specific about, I do think it, like, I watched it a second time and was just struck with how obvious to me it was that it's a trans thing. And they don't mention the word trans or gender or anything. There's one part where she asks him if he likes boys or girls, and he says, I like TV shows, which shows that he's just working it out. He doesn't fucking know. And that context, though, really hit me of Jane talking in the press about how I just came out. It was after she made the last movie. But when they made World's Fair, they were not they were not trans. They did not know that they were a trans person yet. They were not out yet. So in that time, they've come out, and that ending of this movie with that knowledge paired is one of the most devastating, like, forms of personal expression that I have seen in a movie. That's just like, completely outside of the movie. I understand it's like not fair to be like, this movie's important for these outside reasons. But I want to say that aside from the whole, this movie will affect the people it affects in such a meaningful way that just thinking about it brings me to tears thing. The movie itself is so rich and uniquely exciting and unnerving. There are multiple moments that give me goosebumps. Just thinking about the monsters of the week are all very funny and interesting and creepy too. But the big bad, which is, you know, the George Melies moon guy, Mr. Melancholy, the way that that manifests when he comes up in a close up later on, it's one of the most scariest things I've ever seen in a movie. And the last time I said that was World's Fair when there's some creepy face thing happening. So Jane Schoenbrunn is clearly one of my favorite filmmakers going right now. This movie couldn't be more geared to me with the 90s TV pastiche, the lead working at a movie theater. This movie has a literal insert shot of a man putting his hand inside of his chest like Videodrome. It's straight up a Videodrome illusion. This movie is obviously referencing things like The Matrix and Videodrome in its worlds. It's just the most ambitious thing you could possibly do. This is a true case of like an artist using studio money to make something that would never get made otherwise. It couldn't be more personal. And I love that in that personal is something so general that you and I can both talk about it and have completely different reasons for being floored by it. Sorry I talk so much, but that was a lot.
No. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to take in, and it's a lot that needs to be discussed. And I think it's really important for allies, for people who are cis and you know, all of that stuff to support this film, even if you're not going to catch on to the stuff that is there to be decoded. That's not necessarily something you're going to relate to. It is that, and it is something that you are going to relate to as either a horror film, as a story about feeling trapped in your own life and in the world, this little tiny world that you're in. There's going to be something that everybody's going to be able to latch on to here. I also, before we go to the next one, we've talked about Justice Smith before on the show, and we both like him as an actor. He is fantastic here. This is easily his best performance. I think it's probably going to end up being one of the best performances of the year.
The physicality of it, the hunched overness, I called trans voice, that to me was a dead giveaway. But my friend was like, oh, I never thought of it that way. It's just like so obviously like a certain affectation. Keep going. Sorry.
No. It's all of that. And then just that the way that the physicality that's a big part of it. A lot of the dialogue in this is him apologizing for various things, the character apologizing for various things. I'm not going to say specifically where, but it's one of the final moments of the film is that. But you're right. His physicality has that sort of apologetic for his own existence feeling. Yeah. Like he's just there. It's a fantastic performance. I just wanted to highlight that because we have talked about him on the show and we both like him as an actor. This is something that one of those moments where you're like this, he has crossed over to being a great actor, I think, with this performance.
Yeah, it's a terrific performance. The movie is about what it's about, but it's really like, God, I want to talk about it forever. And if you want to know more about it, listen to the New Flesh this week, where I'm sure I'll talk Jesse's ear off about everything I think about every little detail. But it's just about, you know, how all-consuming repression can be. And it's just so interesting that, like, the nostalgia stuff isn't just, like, isn't it great to have these things to look back on? Because, like, when he's an adult and watching the Ice Cream Man again and how different it looks and how, like, we think different context for it. Like, there's so many brilliant things in this movie to think about that it just, like, there's so much to talk about. There's so much to think about. It leaves you going, like, well, that wasn't as easy as saying nostalgia is helpful. And like, or isn't it? It's like, it is helpful and it helps you learn about yourself. But to what point is it like, that's not, you need more than that. You have to accept yourself and, you know, accept some things. And it's crazy because the movie positions like her break from reality, Maddie's break from reality. It's like, is she crazy or did she break through and is it right? Is she doing the right thing? And does he need to fucking do that? So like, it's just such a thorny, interesting movie. And with the added context that I provided, and you can find in all the interviews and stuff with this, the filmmaker, I just think it's such a rich text that is so powerful and is so important. And I know that sounds lofty and crazy if you haven't seen it. And some people will see it and think I'm crazy. And there's some people who completely won't connect with this. And that's totally fine, because the people that do connect with it, as I'm saying, it's going to be life changing. And I just love the message of like, there's still time. That ends up being what the message is because of Jane's personal experience. And oh my God, the way that it casually says at the end, you know, I have a family and we're happy, and you never see the family, and it's clear that he's bullshitting himself.
This is a weird thing. It's one of the best uses of an unreliable narrator, one of the best translations of an unreliable narrator into cinema that I've seen, like that I can think of.
Because, yeah,
you know, that's usually something for a novel. It's, you know, but it is like that moment where he says, I have a family, and
it's,
are you
too
sure
much
about that?
It's too much to think about for me. And like, him talking about the years passing by so quickly, and Jane contextualized that in the interview, talking about how when you're a trans person, you feel like you've lost out on so much time because you don't come to it. People who are specifically very late to realizing that they're trans, you feel like you've lost all this time. So the movie does a great job of compressing the time in that way. So there's just so many elements that I'm sure you're eager to watch it again, like I was, because it's just a movie that sticks in your head and you can't get out. It won't get out of there. And I could watch it again right now and I would find something new to talk about. I've said this last week because Challengers was another best movie of the year. I said it with The Beast a few weeks ago because that's another best movie of the year. But I really do think that I Saw the TV Glow is purely overall my number one right now. And I feel like it's going to be hard to beat. What other movies are going to make me cry when I describe them? Like, it's fucked up. I really hope people go see this and connect with it. If only so we get more work from this filmmaker at the scale that I would like to see it at. Just really remarkable stuff. And I'm obviously 4 stars for I Saw the TV Glow.
Yeah, I'm 3.5, but I mean, that's me.
I feel like
three
you're
and a half.
I feel like you're a rewatch away from a 4-star review, which is how I was.
Very
positive. I was a 3.5 review the first time also. It's open in New York and LA today, and I'm dying to go see it. And wide, I don't know. I think it is actually 2 weeks away that it's wide, but it might be next week.
Yeah, it's 2 weeks. Yeah, there's one more like little whitish.
Does Chicago get it next week or something? Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Got it. All right. Well, there you have it. I Saw the TV Glow. I think that went well. I was really nervous to talk about it because I had so much to say. I hope I said what I had to enough to entice people. Here is the trailer for Tarot, a movie that was once called Horrorscope, based on a novel called a young adult book called Horrorscope, which I think is a better title than Tarot, but I'm not a, you know, marketing executive. Here is the trailer for Tarot.
Twelve cards in a circle. One more at the heart. With this final card, your reading will start.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, this old deck's kind of strange.
Where did you find them?
It's an unspoken rule not to use somebody else's cards.
Who cares? Who's going first?
You see where this is going. And that's the problem with this movie, in a nutshell. You see where this is going. It is the most derivative, perfunctory horror movie. It may as well be called generic PG-13 horror movie. It just is the most base version of itself possible. It unfolds exactly as you expect. No beat is skipped. The death set pieces, which I think could have been so exciting and inventive and creative in like a Nightmare on Elm Street-y visual palette sort of way, and they're just largely underwhelming. And don't make up for the movie's predictability and familiarity. I wouldn't say this movie is like even terrible or bad. It just doesn't stand out and is therefore boring. And I know it's a very tired thing to say at this point, but you could put Cursed Object X Final Destination into ChatGPT or any AI prompt and make this movie. Like, it is that generic, and it really does feel like Final Destination. It's just doing that the whole time. And you get a couple things in your review that I'm very excited to talk about. One is that it's so close to having self-aware humor and being like the kind of parody of itself that it's trying to be. It flirts with that idea, especially with like, they find this lady online to tell them like what it all means. And the one guy being like, I found that this is misinformation. This is a lie. Like, what are you talking about? And they just all move on. So that element's interesting. But the one thing that you said that I was cracking up because I wrote down the exact same note, is it opens with this fucking scene where she gives everyone a tarot reading, and I'm like, am I supposed to be taking notes? Is this going to be on the test? Because it just goes like, oh, this person's going to die this way. This person's going to die this way. This person's going to die this way. And thankfully, The movie also inserts voiceover narration during the death scenes to remind you in case you forgot. So it is on the test, but they have a cheat sheet. So I said all I'm going to say about it. But it wasn't terrible. It just is rote. Terrote. It is very rote.
Yeah. That's... Oh, man. That is really... There's some really either unintentionally or completely orchestrated funny stuff in here. I'm still trying to figure out how those cops think that that first death was an accident, because in reality this mystical tarot based high priestess slams a ladder on this young woman repeatedly, not just once, repeatedly. And I'm just like, do those detectives think the ladder did it on its own? Because that's the only explanation for it being an accident with no sign of foul play.
I appreciated how gruesome that was, actually. I was like, oh, wow, this ladder's scene is gross. Yeah.
This is where I'm going to get to eventually, is that it feels as if those death scenes are completely separate from the entire movie, as if they were shot. Like they were conceived one way, that they were going to be accidents a la Final Destination. And then they realized, wait, we can't do that, because then they're just going to say this was a Final Destination spec script that got flipped into something else. And you know what? I'm going to say, I think this was a Final Destination spec script that got flipped into something else, because it's really weird that just the framing device of all the plotting of just like they die in the same order that their horoscopes happened. Everybody thinks they're accidents, even though it's clear they're not from the way that we see them.
Yeah.
And you're trying to figure out how is death or fate in this case doing it.
Yeah.
And so what it does is there is this very, very real disconnect in terms of the tone, because some of it is funny. And I don't know if it's being intentionally funny or if it's just stupidly accidentally self-aware. And then the death scenes, I think, are like the ladder is gruesome, which is a good thing for this kind of movie. I think the scene in the elevator with the fool is really creepy.
That was my favorite.
I found the magician so weird. So weird that somehow in the cellar of this old house, he is able to magically conjure a creepy audience of zombies to perform a magic trick in front of. I found that so weird that I was into it, because why not? Just go for it. If you're going to make your weird horror movie about tarot card figures coming to life and killing people, make it weird. Make it goofy. Yeah. Do it. So those scenes that actually try to do it and pull it off, I admire them. The rest of the movie is just junk. I mean, the characters you don't care about and doing dumb things. It's all rote horror movie stuff, like you said.
And the explanation is exactly what you think it's going to be from like the opening, like little quick cuts. They're just like, okay, I get it now. It's going to be some sort of this. I'm not going to say what it is, but like it's this thing that's happening, and it ends up being that. But yeah, I just think the tarot card opportunity with each thing does present itself for fun death scenes, and they only do it like a couple of them are okay, but yeah, it just feels like a missed opportunity. The biggest one is that they got some really cool horror artist guy to do like the cards and do the creature design, and they really don't show much of it. They really obscure how much you see people's faces and stuff, and all that stuff does look cool. And just like, why aren't you showing me the things that you spent all this time making? So I definitely thought that. And then a lot of it just manifests as like a screeching scary lady like yelling at you a bunch of times, so like it just isn't that interesting. But you know, it's better than a lot of other shitty horror movies that I've seen, and it's not super offensive or anything like that. It couldn't be more generic, honestly. I said everything I had to say up top, so that's pretty much it. 2 stars for Tarot, which, you know, that's not terrible. Could be worse.
No, it 2 stars for me too. It is definitely not hide it from the critics and don't screen it for anyone sort of bad.
Which is how it got treated, yes.
I'll bet a couple of horror fans who would actually be invited to a screening might find some value in this movie. But whoops, absolutely. They decided Sony once again decided not to screen one of their movies for critics. You know, and here they are.
I read that it's an $8 million budget movie and that they didn't spend any money on TV spots, and they spent all their money on digital. It's like TikTok ads and banner ads online. So we're about to see if that strategy pans out. If this movie makes more than $8 million, I think they'll be very happy.
They're going for the Skinamarink effect, I guess. Yeah,
exactly. All right, let's talk about The Idea of You with Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galzinton, I believe is his name. Here is the trailer. Directed by Michael Showalter of Stella, and now, of course, famed film director. But he was once a comedian. Here's the trailer.
How did you guys meet? We need to know the story.
We met at Coachella. Hi.
Hi.
This is your trailer?
Yeah, I'm in the band. We're performing on the main stage.
August Moon?
Yeah. I met someone tonight. I feel a little inspired. This one's called Closer.
To get closer to you now.
That's a good enough. You get it. So what I will say about this movie is that 50 Shades of Grey opened a perilous door in cinema, in which I don't know if everyone knows the 50 Shades of Grey backstory. Yes, it's this like horny erotic movie about people doing sub-dom relationship or whatever it is, but it was based on initially fan fiction from Twilight. Someone wrote stories in which Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson from Twilight are fucking each other. It's called fan fiction. There's a whole world of this online. And now it became 50 Shades of Grey, multi-billion dollar book series and movie series, whatever it is. And now this movie, The Idea of You, is based on a book, but that book is also just kind of, it's fan fiction that like a 40-year-old housewife wrote about, like, what if I dated Harry Styles? Like, that's essentially what this movie is. What if just a random like suburban housewife, a 40-year-old, dated a 20-year-old pop star? And it's just like an earnest rom-com about that. And, you know, it's kind of base level charming because of Anne Hathaway being a good performer, and the other guy is good too. It's base level charming, but like it gets to a point where the dialogue started to be really cringe to me, and it just like really piled on all of its messaging about like society hates older women, and it just kind of started hitting every cliche in the book. But like, they do a good job of selling a lot of cheesy lines that wouldn't work. But like, there is an exchange that was like, I could be your mother. And he's like, you're not. And she's like, but I could be. And I'm like, is this supposed to be hot? Like, what's going on? I almost think it's charming enough to work, but something about it kept me thinking it was kind of silly. And just like, I'm very much watching a mom fantasize about what it would be like if I got to be with Harry Styles. What did you think of it?
I think on the base level, it's a wish fulfillment sort of movie, but I think it has a sense of its characters. It doesn't just make the connection between them sex. It's about more than that. The big question is from the movie is how would like a 40-year-old single mother, divorced single mother who lives out in the suburbs and doesn't really do much with her life, how would she connect with a 24-year-old pop star who became famous when he was a teenager and has never known an ordinary life at all? Well, how would those two connect? What would they have in common? I think that's the big question. This movie answers it, and I think it gives a convincing answer by saying that they both don't have a sense of purpose, that they both don't really know what it means to live, to have a life outside of their little bubbles. I think it makes that connection. I think the performances are really good. There's a lot of chemistry here between the two of them, and they both give really good performances that are that sort of bubble-ish thing that Hathaway really doesn't understand, like how to go out in the world and meet men. I really like that scene at her birthday party where she's talking to these guys, like, and trying to get something out of them that is meaningful. And one of them is like, oh, I have a kid. And he shows a picture of his dog. It's like, this is what she has to deal with. And then the ex-husband who's a jerk. I like that. I also appreciated the fact that the pop star character is a joke at first, like ordering chicken fingers from room service after they hook up in the hotel room. But he really does become an actual character that you feel something for, that you understand where he's coming from, and you get why maybe he would be attracted to an older woman. But it's more than just that. It's more about that connection. And I bought it. I don't think it quite works with the social commentary stuff. It kind of rushes all of that near the end about once the relationship's found out, and the double standard of, I guess, an older woman dating a younger guy and how she's judged more harshly than the guy. And I didn't quite get where it's trying to go.
Yeah,
with that. I understand it. And I like the fact they bring it up, but it doesn't quite work compared to the relationship itself, which I think does work.
It does start
because
to feel
the performances.
I was going to say, it starts to feel like it's hitting talking points at a certain point towards the end.
Yes. Yeah. But I still think it works because I think it does understand these characters and it cares about them and it finds a reason for them to have a relationship that goes deeper than just attraction. It's got something else going on behind it.
And you know what else I'll say? They actually did a good job of making like fake boy band music. Cause I think they could like sell a record of the pop songs here. And it's like completely competent. Sounds like a boy band stuff that I'm sure people will like. So like they did a good job with that. Good for Michael Showalter making like a movie like this. If that's what he wants to do, good for him. It's not, I didn't hate it or anything. It was like halfway there between being too cliche and charming enough. So I'm 2.5 on the idea of you, but, it's almost there. It's kind of charming. If you're interested, you should check it out. 2.5 stars.
3 stars for me. I'm sorry. It's just the 2.5 is the same thing with the Fall Guy. And I'm just like,
yeah,
there's a lot more chemistry going on in this movie than there was in the Fall Guy. Anyway, just, I know.
Yeah.
Don't compare apples and oranges. It's just funny.
Yeah. They had chemistry. I agree with that. Chemistry's back in a big way at the box right now. It's all sex chemistry, is not dead,
even though apparently it is. Did you read that report that they're saying it's
what, like sex in movies is down or whatever?
Sex in movies is way down.
Yeah.
I don't know if anything here counts as sex. Yeah, it's got to. Anyway.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how that trends over the next but that's a monitoring. It's a thing we'll monitor on the show. How much sex?
Yeah,
is
we will.
In movies. We should have like a new thing at the end where we give a star and then say how much sex is in it just so everyone knows. We'll have a Mr. Skin sponsored portion.
No, let's not do that.
Just kidding.
Sounds like an idea for disaster.
Yeah, we're going to the show will end very quickly. All right. So you said 3 stars, is that right?
Yeah, 3 stars for me on this one.
All right. Let's move on to the Jerry Seinfeld directed and co-written and starring Unfrosted, the Pop-Tart movie on Netflix. Here's the trailer.
2, 1, lift off.
I believe we have split the atom of breakfast. In the early 1960s, the American morning was defined by milk and cereal. And the two undisputed giants of the cereal world were Kellogg's and Post.
Major news from the breakfast world. The Post Cereal Company has reportedly invented a shelf-stable fruit pastry breakfast product.
No.
Yeah.
Boy.
You know, I will say, I appreciated that this movie is very silly. It isn't self-serious like a lot of these other movies that seem to be corporate branded features. So I appreciate the commitment to the bit. I just wish the jokes were funnier. Because how many times can you do a joke that's like, this orange drink has a tang to it. Oh, that's what we'll call it. Or Tony the Tiger trying to figure out a catchphrase. And someone says, that's great nearby or in a different context. And then they go, oh, that's what it should be. Like, that is this entire fucking movie. Is instances like that. It's like the branded content, lazy joke equivalent of a prequel being like, how'd you get that name, Han Solo? Or like, and then explaining shit like that. So I didn't care for most of the jokes, but man, this movie goes for jokes. It is constantly just throwing jokes at you. Every line is a joke and the entire setup is a joke. It's like, what if we treated the invention of the Pop-Tart as if it were like the space race or something of really, you know, a really huge national value and importance. And like, it's kind of funny for a few minutes. It just doesn't really, the movie's only 90 something minutes, but it barely sustains that idea for that entire time. And ultimately, no matter how many times there are, you know, jokes that you laugh at or comedy people that show up and you're like, oh, that's Andy Daly. I like that. That's funny. It's still ultimately a movie that stops cold to have like a sultry montage of the characters eating Kellogg's breakfast cereal. And I think it thinks that the meta-ness of doing that glamour shot is enough to qualify as a joke because we're watching a movie where we know that they're selling us something, but it doesn't land that way. It lands like I'm watching a fucking Kellogg's commercial, which I am. It's a Kellogg's commercial. So it's hard to get too excited about it. It's hard to get too mad about it because it's very silly. It's just like a big joke. Everything's a joke about it. What if we made a movie that Pop-Tarts, the invention of the Pop-Tart was important? Ha ha ha. And I wish Jerry Seinfeld was once a very funny man. The show was funny. Maybe the secret was Larry David, because I haven't found him to be funny in a number of years in his stand-up or on his show, Comedians in Cars, or in this movie. This movie's no Barbie, I guess, as far as like corporate branded content goes. What did you think?
Yeah, there is no such thing as bad advertising. And this movie proves it, because it is clearly trying to make fun of the idea that, you know, cereal and frosted pastries are really important things that deserve movies. But you know what? Those companies don't care. They're getting all of the branding here. They're getting all of the attention. It's the same thing as if they were taking it seriously, basically, on that level. But you are right about the comedy. It's just throw everything at the wall, see what sticks. If it doesn't stick, who cares? We have another joke coming at the wall to stick, maybe. And some of it is funny. I really liked the full honors cereal funeral. I think that that's a really funny bit, because it just keeps going like
the in memoriam thing, or
the funeral, burial.
Yes.
With full cereal honors. It just kept going, and I found that funny. I don't know. You have this many funny people. I mean, the cast list on this thing is nuts. Anything about comedy, you're going to recognize if you don't even know anything about comedy, you're going to recognize like a quarter of the cast, which is huge.
Yeah. Andy Daly as the Quaker Oats guy was my favorite cameo, probably. Just Kyle like Mooney, making fun of him for not having any new products, just oats. Like, that's funny. That's funny.
Kyle Mooney and Mikey Day are two thirds of Snap, Crackle, and Pop.
Yeah. The other one is Drew Tarver, who's a very funny comedian.
I didn't recognize him, but I mean, it doesn't matter, because I recognize
two thirds of them. You have to watch Television's The Other Two. Very funny show.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. But there are so many. I will. There are so many. I'm writing it down here. There are so many. There are so many funny people in this movie. The odds are that something's going to be funny when one of them shows up. And yeah, sometimes it is. I don't really have much to say about it. The jokes are hit and miss. I think they're more misses. I don't think there's any sort of comedic philosophy other than just let's just keep throwing jokes, because it also just, in addition to 60s references, it also for some reason does the storming of the Capitol bit with striking mascots.
Yes,
and I was like, what is the joke here? What is the actual joke here? I don't know what the joke is.
I said that a lot about this movie. What is the joke here?
The Cuban Missile Crisis, apparently caused by a cocaine like sugar dealer. So weird.
There's like this nostalgic boomer stuff in it too. Just like, remember the things from your childhood, that just like is kind of running through it too. That like, you know, it'll go down easy for some people, but it's not the worst thing in the world. I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, it's not. No,
far worse. You know that Bill Pope shot this movie?
No, seriously?
Cinematographer Bill Pope.
No way.
Yes, he shot The Matrix. He shot Scott Pilgrim. He shot all the Spider-Mans, the Raimi Spider-Mans. He shot all the old Raimis.
Oh my God, what the?
Bill Pope, cinematographer of Unfrosted. There was an original song that might get Oscar nominated, just like the Hot Cheetos movie. It's a 2-star thing, but hey, it could have been a 1-star thing. So that's cool. 2 stars. Yeah.
We're apparently very, very, being very generous this movie, because this is getting, the reviews came out today or late last night because of the embargo, and people are hating it. I was kind of surprised. I don't quite get it. Some of it's in bad taste. I didn't like jumping ahead in time to have one of the NASA astronauts be buried with monkeys. That didn't make any sense to me.
There's some fun cameos. Well, there's too many cameos. It's one of those movies that relies too heavily on them, but there's a couple that are like exciting and interesting for reasons I don't want to reveal. But there's like a character cameo more so than like a person cameo that was interesting. A character from another thing that shows up in this movie that I was surprised to see.
Two characters from another thing that show up out of the blue. What's the joke there, though?
It's a joke. That's the joke. The joke is remember this, which is the whole thing.
Yeah.
You think it at least would be what's the deal with? Because it's a Jerry Seinfeld movie, but no.
That would be much better. That's a joke. That is a joke. Remember, this is not a joke, but what's the deal with this thing that you remember? That's a joke. Anyway,
it's funny. People, I guess it is his directorial debut, because I was going to say people forget about B movie, but he didn't.
It's a narrative. Narrative. Yeah. He did a couple of Colin Quinn. Specials.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And does he get credited for, did he direct Comedian or just the that documentary from a million years ago? I don't remember if he actually made that or if he's just the subject of it. Yeah, I think he's just
anyway.
2 stars for Unfrosted, but could have been worse. Are you 2 or 2.5? I missed that.
I'm 2, yeah.
2, I'm okay. 2. All right, let's talk about another movie that I think is opening in limited release and then opening wider. The new film from Ryusuke Hamaguchi, the Oscar-winning director of Drive My Car and also Wheel of Fortune Fantasy. Those both came out the same year. Here is Evil Does Not Exist. Here's a trailer. This is a very striking movie, but it's definitely slow cinema, which is something that a lot of people, including myself, bump up against sometimes. We're just like, won't you end this shot already? I get it. But this one is so purposeful and does it. It's also like under like 100 minutes versus like slow cinema I've seen that's like 3 hours long. So it's very palpable, easy to go down. And when it does get cooking, it's really engaging. It's a movie about, what would you say it's a movie about? Like humanity versus nature, and how it's just about like a town that's trying to like live off the grid or just, you know, be untouched by the ills of society, and like, you know, a corporation trying to put a glamping destination, which you don't know what that means. Glamorous camping. It's like fancy camping, a fancy camping site near them, and how that would affect this town. And there's this amazing centerpiece scene. I think the whole movie works around, which is like these corporate entity people coming to town and trying to give them, you know, corporate speak about how it's great for the area. And the townspeople start peppering them with very basic questions that they should have the answers to, that are very like obvious issues. Like, hey, like you can't put a septic tank here.
Because
you can't put a septic tank here because it will pollute our waters downstream. And their answers are like, thank you for your feedback. We will get this back to you soon. Like, your valuable input will be considered. It's like talking to a fucking wall. And as someone who has to deal with corporate stuff at work, it is a very great depiction of trying to have a reasonable conversation with a corporate entity, and you're just never going to get anywhere. So that scene's kind of the centerpiece of the movie. And I think we both agree that like the ending leaves a lot to be desired, or maybe just puts too fine a point on things in a way that I wasn't expecting. But it does open up the conversation to like to chew on it a little bit, what they're trying to say here. And I think it's ultimately a very moving movie, regardless of how you feel about the ending. And what did you think of it?
Yeah, I think it works regardless of the ending, which I don't think it's a matter of like the ending doesn't have anything to say. It's just that it's so oddly clunkily assembled. It's so weird.
I kind of get
a meticulous filmmaker. He's such a meticulous filmmaker that it's so weird just out of the blue at the very end to kind of deal with like flashbacks within scenes that are happening in the moment. And
yeah, it was definitely a very artful choice that either works for you, or you're going to be like, that was too much. Or
it was just, it's a weird thing. It's just a weird thing that he spends so much time with those long shots of the main character chopping wood and gathering water from the stream and doing all this. So you understand exactly how the processes of this town work and how his life goes, the routines of his life in such detail. And then just at the end to just kind of like mess it all up with a little weirdly edited scene. But the point is, because we get into the rhythms of this place where time doesn't even seem to exist. I love that shot when he goes to pick up his daughter from school and all the kids are just frozen. And I thought, wait, is this like a surreal moment that he's just like really heightening? And they're just playing like a game of red light, green light. That's all they're doing. But it it works so well of that idea of time and everything moving so slowly and everything moving, being so particular and exacting in this town. So when those corporate people show up, who, by the way, work for a talent agency, which is really funny because they really don't know what's going on. And they're in there getting peppered with all these questions that are really important. Like, wait, you're saying it's going to be good for our business, but if you also are having barbecue sites, why are they going to come to my noodle restaurant? That doesn't make any sense. What are you saying? And they have no clue how to answer it. It's a great scene. And because you feel how this town works and why it's important to the people who are there and all those little tiny things that could go wrong and you know are going to go wrong, you really understand that. And it's a bit funny, but it's also a bit tragic. And it works as an environmentalist parable because it is really getting at this idea. I just love the way that the main character puts it, that we are upstream of everything below us. And so we have a responsibility to everybody below us to take care of this area because it's going to affect a lot more than just us if we don't do it. That's our problem right now. It's like none of us care. None of us have any responsibility because we're not thinking about other people beyond ourselves. And that's, you know, it goes beyond the environment, I think. It's just this little empathetic story about this little village that's trying to keep itself going and, you know, how badly it could go when all these entities that are just going in for profit come in. It's a nice little parable that works because it takes its time, I think.
Yeah, you really get a feel for the character, not only the characters, but like their connection to the area. And it really makes all the difference. And there's like, you know, some people may say like the deer metaphor might be a little heavy handed or something like that. But I really do think as like a parable message movie type of thing, it really is powerful. And I like a great way to like verbalize or, you know, put in the movie, verbalize isn't the right word, like to get at the idea of the inhumanity of like, how corporations don't really speak the same language of humanity and they don't really consider such things. And like the perspective the characters take is actually really interesting and how they shift throughout the movie. It's really strong. I really enjoyed this. It's a very strong 3-star movie. I didn't quite love it as much as like Drive My Car, which I think is terrific.
Yeah.
And so is Wheel of Fortune Fantasy. He's a great filmmaker. And this is another great movie from him, but maybe not my favorite of his. So 3 stars for me.
Three stars for me as well. Yeah, three for me too. You brought up the thing about the deer and not understanding. There's that part where our main character says to the corporate guy, like, this is on a deer trail. And the corporate guy's immediate response is, well, I mean, it's not going to hurt our customers, right? Like, he doesn't even think about like what it's going to do to the deer. Just that.
Exactly.
That tunnel vision. Exactly. Yeah. Such little nice little details that reveal so much about the way that people think.
Yeah. You nailed it. That's why it works. All right, let's talk about the last movie of the day. We're gonna split on it. Here's a movie called New Life, a little indie I knew nothing about that I thought was a good time, and Mark did not. Here's the trailer.
That is brutal, actually. I have to say, that's probably...
I am done.
You've been living on the streets?
I'm traveling.
Why are you helping me?
Freedom of reinvention built this country. I don't intend to get in its way.
We believe the subject is en route to the border. We can't let her cross. We need our best on it.
You start. I thought this was unexpected. Like, I knew nothing about it. And I thought it was very engaging. And naturally reveals information in a way that I found compelling and was a nice little cat and mouse thing. What didn't work for you?
The evasiveness of it, I think, work for me.
Okay.
Okay. So it's a movie about, it's a cat and mouse chase. It's a movie about a young woman being pursued by this unknown entity, this unknown organization, and this tracker. And that's all we know. And so you kind of like get into it assuming, because the young woman is the character that we first see, and she has a tragic backstory apparently with a fiance that is not in the picture, although we don't know why, we don't know how it happened. but we're supposed to relate to her. She's a protagonist just by virtue of being on screen more often than the other characters. And then, obviously, the other character who has a pistol and is tracking the character we assume is the protagonist is the antagonist. It's a weird little experiment in just why do we care about characters in a movie if we know nothing about them just by the virtue of them being on the camera and how they're framed? And so that's what I, because we really know nothing. We know nothing about anything that's going on. We just know there's a young woman on the run and someone is chasing her and that's it. And eventually it reveals why. And I didn't find that a justifiable enough excuse.
Different reaction. I heard when it revealed what was happening, I was like, ooh, cool. And then I think it took it a step further by going into like a horror mode that I didn't expect or see was coming. So I was like, this just got gnarly. This is cool. And I was just fully on board with it, even though, I don't know, arguably the stretch between the two characters, I guess, would be the big, I thought that would be your big problem. Like, these people are like, they're saying like, look at these two people who are connected or in different ways. And it's just like a stretch or something. That's what I expected.
I didn't see that. I don't know how much I want to give away. I think it's revealed like really quick that the tracker has Lou Gehrig's disease. And so she's dealing with that while trying to chase this other woman. Maybe it's a weird thing to try to connect those two parallels of what they're experiencing. Maybe it's a little weird, but that wasn't the problem. The problem was that it's just keeping so much information from us. And so when it does get revealed, it kind of just, I don't know, it just fizzled out for me. I didn't see any, it doesn't ask any of the big questions that you think it would ask about ethics and about responsibility, a personal responsibility for a large scale problem. I guess that's the best way to put it. Like what kind of role do you have in a situation where you could cause a bigger problem for a lot of the world if you keep going about doing your own thing? I don't know. I don't want to get into it, but it doesn't ask any questions. It's tough to talk about because it is.
It's hard to talk about for
more
sure.
than halfway through. Yeah.
It's
more
hard
than
to talk about.
It reveals what's going on.
Yeah. So I guess. Yeah, I hear all your criticisms. I just thought it was like, engaging on like a purely thriller level, a cat and mouse chase. You don't know what's going on. It eventually reveals what's going on. And then when it does, I did find it to be weighty and interesting. And I was like, oh, shit, this is compelling. But like, maybe you're right that it'd be better if she knew. Talking around it. Maybe if she knew what was happening, it'd be better because about the personal responsibility part of it and like that stuff and the implications. But because she doesn't, it's just kind of hapless. But because she doesn't, it makes it an intense chase for the person chasing her. But maybe that doesn't come through enough is what you're saying, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think it comes through enough. And also, I mean, I think she would know at a certain point because we have those flashbacks, too. And I mean, it's not a big stretch to try to figure out. But maybe she's in denial about it. I don't know. It's these characters are so empty and so shallow. There's nothing to them except what is put upon them by the filmmaker that, you know, we have the hero and we have the villain. But why is she the hero and why is she the villain? And maybe they're not so different. And maybe there is a reason that the hero should be chased, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. It just wasn't enough. It wasn't enough.
Fair enough. I say it is enough, and it's a fun, cool movie if you're in the mood for a little indie thriller that doesn't like a no-budget situation that has some unexpected twists in it. I thought it was, again, without revealing anything, we're talking around it. I thought it was just like a really fun ride where I didn't know where it was going to go, and where it did end up going, I enjoyed the journey. So I guess that's the difference between Mark and I on that. But just a respectable 3 stars on New Life. I thought it was really cool, and I definitely recommend it. Mark, where are you?
2 stars for me. It's experiment sort of in narrative. I don't think it pulls it off.
Well, there you have it. That was 7 movies for 6 more. Go to markreviewsmovies.com. And while I plug my Alien Ant Farm song Movies that is about to start right now, I'm just going to, for no reason, no one asked me to, they have a new album out. You can buy a new Alien Ant Farm album right now. Maybe if they hear this, they'll come do the show. And I would love for them to perform Movies live acoustically. That is the goal for this podcast. It's going to happen. I'm going to reach out to their booker right now. In the meantime, Alien Ant Farm. Movies.
The show starts in one...
Shut up. Ush.